And you'd think a world that uses email constantly might have forgotten all about letters. And maybe we don't write them much anymore, but we sure like to read them. Case in point, letters of note. Sean Usher put the website up several years ago, displaying letters people had written to each other, people known and not, letters happy and sad and everywhere in between. And lo and behold, people came to the site in droves. So now there's another book, Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean Usher is a writer who lives in the United Kingdom. He created Letters of Note online several years ago. Also runs the site Lists of Note. We have talked about the books about both projects, so it's a third visit to the Exchange for Sean Usher. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Always good to have you. This project has really clearly taken on a life of its own. Did you ever think it would get this big?
Goodness, no. When I started this in 2009, it was a hobby. It really was a hobby. It was an obsession. And to think that, I think it's 110 million people have visited the website since then, which just, it blows my mind, you know? And it's also, so it spawned a book, the first book in 2013, which has been translated into 22 languages. And then we also do live events. So we get famous people up on stage, you know, proper actors, you know, talented people, not me, to read out some of these letters. And it really has taken on a life of its own. But I am so, so pleased to see an obsession of mine just kind of spread its wings. I couldn't have imagined this would happen.
It's an infectious obsession, obviously. What started your own fascination with it, Sean?
Sorry?
What started your own fascination with letters?
It was when I first met my 13 years ago. I'm not sure what year it was. She moved away to Spain, something like 2 weeks after we started dating. So, and she lived there for 10 months. So we spent essentially the first year of our relationship hundreds of miles apart. But we made, I can't remember the reason, but we made a conscious effort to stay in touch by letter. So we fell in love by letter. We wrote to each other the old-fashioned way for 10, 11 months and fell in love with each other by letter. And it was the best possible start we could have had, because I am absolutely certain, as is she, that had we, you know, just emailed each other or text messaged each other or just kept in touch on Facebook, there's no way we would have learned as much as we have during that 10 months, because when you sit down to write a letter, this is true for us too anyway, you're far more willing to be, you know, open and honest. I'm pretty sure it acts as a different part of your brain. And what comes out of you is just far more pure than if you write an email. But then we fell in love by letter over those 10 months. And I also fell in love with letter writing and just obsessed with the idea of letter writing, obsessed with letters themselves, and really quite obsessed with the fact that we might be losing that very slowly. I mean, you know, letter writing has been dying since the telegram first came along, you know, decades ago. But it really feels like, you know, the letter is on its deathbed.
So what, when you choose a letter, is it the who that confers status or the what?
In all honesty, it's a combination. The thing is, it's far easier to find letters written by famous people. That's just the way it is, because, you know, normal people don't often have their letters published in books or kind of held in archives, which is really sad, because it's just unfair. So if I can find an amazing letter written by a non-famous person, then that I feel like I struck gold. Because they are harder to find. But, you know, it's all about the message, really. If a letter, you know, hits me right there, then I consider it, you know, worthy of the website or one of the books. But I'm generally a sucker for emotional letters. If a letter even close to brings me to tears, then, you know, I'll whack it on there. I could easily fill up a few books full of just heartbreaking, soul-destroying letters. It's quite an addiction.
You mentioned in the introduction to this edition of Letters of Note, Volume 2, that this is a bit of a logistical nightmare, and I wonder how you even keep track of what you have. I mean, it sounds like you've got a bit of an encyclopedia in your own head to be able to think, oh, that reminds me of a letter by so-and-so.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is my job now. I've done nothing but this for the past 5 years, so it's all I think about, really. I don't have a particularly good memory, but when it's all you think about, it's hard to forget these amazing letters. I live by spreadsheets. I have approximately 100 spreadsheets just full of these amazing letters. And, you know, the permission, one of the hardest parts, the logistical nightmare is getting permission to use these letters. So I have to be in touch with, and a lot of these letters are written by people that have since died. So I'm in touch with people's estates and families, and, you know, I meet some amazing people through this process. But just getting permission and tracking down the original letters is really, really difficult. It gets out of hand sometimes. But without spreadsheets, I would be a broken man. Well, I wouldn't have this job.
Well, thank you, XL, for keeping Sean whole and hearty. Robert Crumb gets the first letter in the book, and it's not a love letter. What happened to provoke his letter?
This is one of my favorite ever letters, actually. And this was written not long ago. You know, it's one of the few letters that was written in recent years. There's a Swedish jazz saxophonist called Mats Gustafsson who idolized, or still idolizes, Robert Crumb. So Mats Gustafsson sent a copy of his upcoming album to Robert Crumb and asked for his opinion. Robert Crumb, very honestly sent his opinion back. Shall I read it out?
We don't have time. We're going to have to get to that on the second part of a break, but after okay. The break, I mean. But it's quite a letter. We'll get to the first of these letters in Letters of Note, Volume 2. Sean Usher has saved the world for correspondence by saving these letters and putting them out in front of the world. And as you've heard, 110 million people have now gone to website and books, and probably more than that when you combine them. We'll come back and talk more with Sean and hear of some of the letters of note in his voice and in some other famous people from the Letters Live series. We'll get into that as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Sean Usher and Letters and You in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Sean Usher is our guest once again. He put up a website called Letters of Note almost 8 years ago now, and has had 110 million people visit ever since to look at some of these letters he's put up from people known and not, old and new, happy and sad, and every place in between. It's resulted in a couple of books as well. The latest is called Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. And you can be the audience to tell us about some letters that appeal to you, correspondence you might have written over the years, or read over the years, rather, that appeals to you. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Robert Crumb, the famous artist, had been approached by Mats Gustafsson to do what now?
So he sent him a copy of his new Swedish jazz album and asked for his opinion. And so Robert Crumb, who's an incredibly honest person, wrote back a letter in which he said stuff like, "Quite frankly, I was kind of shocked at what a negative, unpleasant experience it was listening to it. I had to take it off long before it reached the end. I just don't get it. I don't understand what it's about. You actually go on tour with this stuff. Wow. People actually sit and listen to that. I mean, they voluntarily go to the place, maybe even pay to hear that stuff, and they sit there quietly, politely, and listen. Unbelievable. I should go myself sometime and see this." And he just carries on and on. But he also says that he says, "I got to tell you, on the cover of the CD, I wrote in large block letters in silver ink, torturing the sax." And so Mac, can you imagine receiving that kind of response from your hero? So Mats Gustafsson, when he received this letter, he adored it. I mean, he must have been a little bit hurt, but he actually adored the response. And he called the album, when it eventually came out, he called the album Torturing the Saxophone. It's just like it's the perfect story. And I got in touch with Robert Crumb, and I said, "Robert, do you mind if I use this letter?" Thinking he might be a bit kind of defensive about it. Uh-huh. But he was like, "No, yeah, go for it. Yeah, I love that letter." He was saying it really... really pleased for it to go in the book.
Wow, it's amazing stuff. It's not, but he does say, you know, I don't say this to, with the intention to insult you, and you know, obviously Mats Gustafsson did some great stuff with it. Is it just me, Sean, or do letters on paper seem to have more emotional range than email? I mean, more room to be funny, even.
I think so. Yeah. Well, I think it's just with me. It's when I sit down, if I'm sat at the computer just writing an email, I've always got my mind on something else. You know, I've either got a load of tabs open on the computer, or you know, I'm reading a book as well as reading the or trying to send this email. But if I write a letter, if I get out the typewriter, or I just get a pen and paper, I'm completely focused, and I channel. I don't know. I'm far more open and honest and creative. I think it feels like more of a creative endeavor to write a letter than to write an email. Emails are just too easy. Facebook messages are too easy. It's you know, you don't spend a lot of time doing it, because it's very easy to just delete mistakes. Mm-hmm. With a letter, you really have to concentrate, and I think that brings out all sorts of good things as well as bad things. You know, it's also easier to write devastating letters, you know, angry letters, than it is emails. But you know, I think it's definitely a far more interesting medium.
Spike Milligan shows up in the book a few times. For American audiences, who was he?
Well, he's one of the UK's, you know, best loved comedians. He was in a series called The Goons years ago. He also had he was just a much beloved comedian. And again, there are so many books of his letters. He was an avid letter writer. The difficulty, I'm always holding myself back thinking, oh, should I just have one more Spike Milligan letter in the book? it's really difficult not to just include all of his letters. But yeah, there are a couple of his in the book. Well, there's one written to him by Peter Sellers, who was his, you know, a fellow actor on The Goons, who was also in Pink Panther films. And there's a letter that Spike Milligan wrote to George Harrison, because they were friends.
I want to talk about the Peter Sellers note first, though, because that's a very short, sweet note, apparently fairly late in Peter Sellers' life. What was he asking Spike Milligan for?
Yeah, so the Goons split up. They stopped doing the Goons show, and Peter Sellers was absolutely, you know, devastated not to be doing this show again. So near the end of his life, it was very near the end of his life, he sent this this telegram to Peter Sellers, in which he says, "Dear Spike, I am desperate to have some real fun again with you and Harry." Harry was Harry Secombe. He was another one of the Goons. "Please, can we get together and write some more Goon shows? We could place them anywhere. I don't want any money. I will just work just for the sheer joy of being with you both again as we were. Love, Peter." And he died shortly after that.
Oh.
In fact, it was days after that. Which is absolutely tragic, but they were incredible people.
We have the sound of Andrew Scott reading Spike Milligan's letter to George Harrison. Can you explain before we hear it what the relationship between them was?
So they met early on in Spike Milligan's career, and they were just really good friends. But Spike Milligan was absolutely he was infuriated because George Harrison was terrible at keeping in touch with people. And he would never reply to his letters or his phone calls or any form of communication. It was really hard for Spike to get hold of George Harrison.
So here's how Spike Milligan explains all this. Here's his letter to George Harrison.
"I phone you frequently and never get a reply. This is what you do. It's very simple. You stand in front of a telephone and you insert your fingers in the holes and carry out a series of numbers which have been given to you. Of course, if you are rich, you have two buttons, which Irishmen usually sew on their coats. Of course, if you are extremely rich, you don't have to get in touch with anybody, and that's what I am worried about. The funeral takes place at Golders Green Crematorium. No flowers, please. Just money. You'll recognize me. I'm the dead one. Love, light, and peace. Spike Milligan."
Spike Milligan writing to George Harrison, as read by Andrew Scott, who played Moriarty in the Sherlock series and is just a fine actor in his own right. Any idea if George eventually called in response to this letter?
Sorry, say that again?
Any idea if George eventually called Spike in response to that letter?
I have no idea, and I've tried to find out, but it's impossible information to get hold of. Even Spike's secretary, who you know helps to publish these letters, she's not too sure either. But yeah, that's one of life's frustrations, not finding out the end of the story.
We nabbed the Andrew Scott audio doing Spike Milligan from the Letters Live series. Tell us about what those events are about.
So yeah, this when the first book came out in 2013 here in the UK, we decided just as part of the launch party in London to get a few people up to read some letters from the book, and it just so happened that my publisher knows Benedict Cumberbatch, so Benedict got up on stage and read a letter. The musician Nick Cave got up and read his own letter. Gillian Anderson from The X-Files, she read a letter. And it just went down so well. It was such a perfect atmosphere, and it was just so well received that we thought, why don't we carry on doing these? Why don't we make this a regular event? So we started a company called Letters Live, and Benedict Cumberbatch is a partner of the company. And we throw these events, usually here in London, and just get up to a dozen amazing performers to read out letters on stage, and it is the most amazing experience. It's unlike any other show you go to. It's not really been done before, and yeah, we've played to thousands of people now. We're going to LA in February to do a show, and we're going to be in New York later in the year to do a few shows. But they're, you know, to hear these, a lot of these letters are written privately, you know, so they're only meant to be read by one person, to be experienced by one person. So to bring that onto the stage and to have it heard by thousands of people, it's an incredible, incredible evening. So, long may it continue.
Yeah, they took some great collection of talent you've got there. We're talking about Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean Usher functioning as editor for this, as he has for the whole series. He put up his website about 8 years ago and got 110 million visitors to it so far. People really took to writing other people's or reading other people's mail. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about some of these notable letters and hear more of them. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Not surprising to see a letter from Abraham Lincoln in here because he was such a good writer, but this is not on some grand political scale. What did you select for this volume, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, Lincoln, as you'd expect, was an amazing writer. He wrote some beautiful, beautiful letters. But this one was written to the daughter of a friend who had died. And the daughter was absolutely devastated, she's completely distraught. And Lincoln heard that she was really, really finding it difficult just to survive because she was so, you know, just depressed, essentially. So he wrote this beautiful letter. Shall I read this out? It's quite a short one.
Yes, please.
Dear Fanny, it is with deep grief that I learn of the death of your kind and brave father, and especially that it is affecting your young heart beyond what is common in such cases. In this sad world of ours, sorrow comes to all, and to the young it comes with bitterest agony, because it takes them unawares. The older have learned to ever expect it. I am anxious to afford some alleviation of your present distress. Perfect relief is not possible, except with time. You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. Is not this so? And yet, it is a mistake. You are sure to be happy again. To know this, which is certainly true, will make you some less miserable now. I have had experience enough to know what I say, and you need only to believe it, to feel better at once. The memory of your dear father, instead of an agony, will yet be a sad, sweet feeling in your heart, of a purer and holier sort than you have known before. Please present my kind regards to your afflicted mother, your sincere friend, A. Lincoln. So, yeah, just so eloquent and generous, you know. He was really generous with his letters.
Truly he was, and this from a man, I don't know where in his life he wrote this, but he lost three children of his own.
Yeah, he was no stranger to grief. Maybe that's why he wrote such a beautiful letter and, you know, took the time to do it. But, you know, this wasn't unusual for Abraham Lincoln. He was he was very generous with his time. But, you know, back in the day, people used to write a lot of letters. It seems now quite strange to see people making such an effort, but this was quite normal back in the day.
It was. They didn't have TV and all the other diversions that we have in today's world.
Exactly.
There's a bittersweet letter in here from Rachel Carson, well known as the author of Silent Spring. And what's hers about?
So, yeah, this was quite near the end of her life. You can see a pattern emerging here, can't you?
Right, yeah.
So She died from cancer, and near the end of her life, she took a walk with one of her very good friends along the coast. Her friend was called Dorothy, and they watched. Rachel Carson was a huge lover of wildlife and nature, and they watched some monarch butterflies migrating during this walk. And then she wrote this beautiful letter to her friend afterwards. And it says, "Dear one, this is a postscript to our morning at New Argan, something I think I can write better than say. For me, it was one of the loveliest of the summer's hours, and all the details will remain in my memory. That blue September sky, the sounds of the wind in the spruces and surf on the rocks, the gulls busy with their foraging, alighting with deliberate grace, the distant views of Griffith's Head and Todd Point, today so clearly etched, though once half seen in swirling fog. But most of all, I shall remember the monarchs, the unhurried westward drift of one small winged form after another, each drawn by some invisible force. We talked a little about their migration, their life history. Did they return? We thought not. For most, at least, this was the closing journey of their lives. But it occurred to me this afternoon, remembering, that it had been a happy spectacle, that we had felt no sadness when we spoke of the fact that there would be no return. And rightly, for when any living thing has come to the end of its life cycle, we accept that end as natural. For the monarch, that cycle is measured in a known span of months. For ourselves, the measure is something else, the span of which we cannot know. But the thought is the same. When that intangible cycle has run its course, it is a natural and not unhappy thing that a life comes to an end. That's what those brightly fluttering bits of life taught me this morning. I found a deep happiness in it. So I hope, may you. Thank you for this morning. Rachel."
Rachel being Rachel Carson, as read by Sean Usher, the editor of Letters of Note, Volume 2. It's very uplifting for someone who realizes her time is coming to an end.
Isn't it? It's just incredible. And so it's so lovely to know that she had this kind of realization as she was, you know, nearing the end of her life, knowing that, you know, it's only really with humans that, you know, becoming deeply kind of depressed about death, when it's actually just a natural part of life, and it is actually a beautiful thing to happen. It's now, just a lovely, lovely thing.
There's a more somber one here from Alan Turing, and we do have a clip of this. This is Benedict Cumberbatch reading a letter from Alan Turing to a friend at a particularly pivotal moment in his life.
"I have now got myself into the kind of trouble that I have always considered to be quite a possibility for me, though I have usually rated it at about 10-1 against. I shall shortly be pleading guilty to a charge of sexual offences with a young man. The story of how it all came to be found out is a long and fascinating one, which I shall have to make into a short story one day, but haven't the time to tell you now. No doubt I shall emerge from it all a different man, but quite who, I've not found out. Glad you enjoyed the broadcast. Jefferson certainly was rather disappointing, though. I'm afraid that the following syllogism may be used by some in the future. Turing believes machines can think. Turing lies with men. Therefore, machines do not think. Yours in distress, Alan."
Well, he was ultimately wrong, but it took a while. I mean, Alan Turing has had quite a rehab, hasn't he, Sean?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it did take a long time. I mean, it's not long since he was pardoned. But yeah, I mean, I think 2 years after that letter was written, he took his own life after being chemically castrated. It's absolutely, absolutely tragic. But yeah, Benedict obviously played the part of Alan Turing in The Imitation Game.
Mm-hmm.
So it was equally, you know, doubly kind of powerful when he took the stage to read that. But yeah, so really, really devastating letter.
Now, there is a letter in here from Karen Cook to Joan Cook Carpenter, which is a letter to someone who's passed on. There's an interesting one who actually comes from someone who's passed on. What is the story of the Vivian Rosewarne letter?
Sorry?
The Vivian Rosewarne letter. Can you tell us what that's about?
Oh, sure, yeah. This was written, what's the year? It's 1940. So Vivian Rosewarne was a flying officer in the RAF. This letter was discovered after his death, and it was written to his mother. And it was then published in the Times, and it became so popular because it's such a beautiful letter that it was published as a book, as a short book, and broke all sorts of records. It was it's a hugely popular letter, and it's a letter to his mother in which he talks about kind of. He says, "I firmly believe that evil things are sent into the world to try us. They are sent deliberately by our Creator to test our mettle, because He knows what is good for us. The Bible's full of cases where the easy way out has been discarded for moral principles. I count myself fortunate in that I've seen the whole country and known men of every calling. But with the final test of war, I consider my character fully developed." So it's a really kind of another powerful letter.
Truly, from somebody that people hadn't known the name of before he died, and then the letter and he took on a life of their own afterward. One of many, many things involved in Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean Usher is the editor and compiler of all the Letters of Note efforts, and we're going to talk more with him when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take some phone calls and emails from you. That'll be in a minute 25. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sean Usher, the writer from the United Kingdom, who has joined us twice before to talk about some of the amazing things he collects. He loves letters and lists. He put out the website Letters of Note nearly 8 years ago now and has had 110 million visitors to it. It spawned a book, Letters of Note. We're now on Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Many letters from many people in many circumstances. And you can join us as we talk about this. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just were talking about the Vivian Rosewarne letter, which was a sad story of a soldier who died in World War II writing a letter to his mother to be delivered upon his death, and it was. Another story from World War II, though, on a much lighter note, Evelyn Waugh wrote a letter to his wife, and we have audio from a portion of this by Jeffrey Palmer. Can you set this up for us just a bit, Sean?
This is one of my favorite letters. This was World War II, as you said. Evelyn Waugh at the time was in the Royal Horse Guards in southwest Scotland, and his wife was back home. She was about to give birth to their fourth child, and so he wrote this letter back to try and cheer her up, and it really did, as you'll soon hear.
Well, so the circumstance here is that there's a bit of a demonstration of explosives, and Lord Glasgow, who owns the property, says, "I don't want any of my trees harmed," and the explosive experts say, "Okay, fine," and here's Evelyn Waugh telling the rest of it.
They all went out to see the explosion, and Colonel DS, DSO, said, "You will see that tree fall flat at just that angle, where it will hurt no young trees." And Lord Glasgow said, "Goodness, you are clever." So, soon they lit the fuse and waited for the explosion. And presently, the tree, instead of falling quietly sideways, rose 50 feet into the air, taking with it half an acre of soil and the whole of the young plantation. And the subaltern said, "Sir, I made a mistake. Should have been £7.5, not 75. Lord Glasgow was so upset, he walked in dead silence back to his castle. And when they came to the turn of the drive in sight of his castle, what should they find but that every pane of glass in the building was broken? So, Lord Glasgow gave a little cry and ran to hide his emotion in the lavatory. And there, when he pulled the plug, the entire ceiling, loosened by the explosion, fell on his head. This is quite true. E."
E meaning Evelyn Waugh. Jeffrey Palmer reading this letter magnificently. Was this a true story? Were you able to find out, Sean?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't really care. It's just so amusing, and it's so well written that I would, it just doesn't matter to me. But we do this every time a letter's live, and it has everyone in stitches. It's just such a funny, funny letter. I mean, it's somebody it brings to mind Fred Allen. I'm a huge fan of Fred Allen's, and his letters are some of the funniest things I've ever read in my life. And again, it's a struggle not to just use them all the time.
Well, that was the next question forming, was how you managed to hold yourself back. I mean, you could probably run entire books of Fred Allen letters or Evelyn Waugh letters, and how you managed to find your way to being democratic in this process.
Well, I just forced myself. You know, I've repeated. So in the first book, there's Spike Milligan. In the second book, there's Spike Milligan. There are quite a few people that have appeared in both volumes, but I do kind of hold myself back. I mean, there are billions of letters that have been written in history. So for me to start repeating letters would be a crime. I've barely scratched the surface.
Truly, truly. So how far back in time do you go? You have some letter from ancient Egypt in here or someplace?
Yeah, that's right. Well, in the first book, there's a letter from 200 BC, which is, you know what I've realized doing this? I've looked at letters that are so, so old. You know, letters that were kind of carved into clay or written on tree bark. And what I've realized is that we haven't changed. We've always been writing about the same problems. We've always been getting emotional about the same things. It's what the political landscape has always been essentially the same. Very little has changed. It's just the medium on which we write these letters. And there's one from 200 BC written in ancient China in which someone, a government official is apologizing for getting really drunk the night before, and he's apologizing to his host, saying, I just drank too much. I didn't know what was going on. And I'm just thinking, you could have written that today. You know, nothing has changed. We're just as pathetic. We're just as emotional as we always have been about the same subject.
And it's funny to think about the very same kinds of circumstances. They'll say, sorry, I got drunk and made a butthead out of myself at your house last night, or whatever the circumstances were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the sort of thing I would write.
Not often, I hope.
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Okay, there's a great question, though. Are you still writing letters, given you're spending so much time with other people's letters?
I do write. I mean, I was going to say I'm as bad as the next person, but I suppose I write more than most people. But, you know, far too often I will just write an email instead because it is so much easier, and I kick myself every single time. Because I know that by writing an email, I've written something that's not as interesting or honest as it could have been. But, you know, I'm just, as all people do, I blame it on busyness. I've got so much to do that, you know, writing an email is so much easier. I mean, who's got time these days to get a stamp and put a stamp on a letter and, you know, find an envelope and walk down to the post box when I could instead be, I don't know, reading Donald Trump's tweets? I don't know. I'm pretty bad myself.
Well, you know, since you raised the subject, I was going to ask you about emails and tweets, since those have both figured prominently in the American election campaign. Mm. And I just wonder what you've made of the methods of correspondence, if nothing else.
Well, you know, I found it very odd to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tweeting. Although I don't think Hillary actually tweets herself, I do believe that. Well, Donald Trump clearly does do his own tweets sometimes. It very quickly became normal. You know, it's amazing how quickly you adapt to seeing, you know, people in positions of power tweeting, because it's just become the norm so quickly. You know, it's just the way of the world, and it just makes me sad to think that in future, you know, our grandkids are going to be looking back at and being taught history. You know, they're going to be in history class being taught about tweets that Donald Trump sent rather than beautiful letters that Abraham Lincoln sent. It's a bit depressing.
Oh, I could see that. All right, so let's get out of the depression by listening to Helen Keller as read by Gillian Anderson. She wrote a letter to the New York Symphony. What prompted this?
Well, Helen Keller, as you know, is deaf and blind, but she used to listen to things on the radio by holding her hand on the speaker, and she used to feel the vibrations and, you know, in her own way, listen to things. So, and she listened to Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 being played by the New York Symphony Orchestra in 1924, And she adored it, and she wrote a letter just to explain how lovely she found it.
So we pick this up right after Helen Keller explains that she laid her hand on the speaker paper and could feel the vibrations there. So here's Gillian Anderson reading Helen Keller's letter to the New York Symphony.
And I lightly touched the sensitive diaphragm. What was my amazement to discover that I could feel not only the vibrations, but also the impassioned rhythm, the throb and the urge of the music, the intertwined and intermingling vibrations from different instruments enchanted me. I could actually distinguish the cornets, the roll of the drums, deep-toned violas and violins singing in exquisite unison. How the lovely speech of the violins flowed and plowed over the deepest tones of the other instruments. When the human voice leapt up, trilling from the surge of harmony, I recognized them instantly as voices. I felt the chorus grow more exultant, more ecstatic, upcurving, swift and flame-like, until my heart almost stood still. The women's voices seemed an embodiment of all the angelic voices rushing in a harmonious flood of beautiful and inspiring sound. The great chorus throbbed against my fingers with poignant pause and flow. Then all the instruments and voices together burst forth an ocean of heavenly vibration and died away like winds when the atom is spent, ending in a delicate shower of sweet notes. Of course, this was not hearing, but I do know that the tones and harmonies conveyed to me moods of great beauty and majesty. I also sensed, or thought I did, the tender sounds of nature that sing into my hand, swaying reeds and winds, and the murmur of streams. I have never been so enraptured before by a multitude of tone vibrations.
Gillian Anderson reading a letter from Helen Keller to the New York Symphony, part of Letters of Note, Volume 2. Sean Usher is the editor with us here on The Exchange. That's an amazing letter, and actually goes on for quite a while. She explained, too, the hollowness of the sound. That was Gillian Anderson reading it to a room full of people, all in rapt silence, as you could hear. And I love, Sean, Helen Keller's reference to Ludwig von Beethoven, the composer, being deaf as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it took me a long time to even realize. I missed that the first time, well, the first few times. She was an amazing writer. She had such a way with words. There's another letter she wrote when she went to the top of the Empire State Building for the first time, and she talked about seeing the view and this, you know, about how beautiful the architecture was, even though she couldn't actually see it. I mean, she had an amazing way with words, and she could really kind of, she could vocalize things like no other.
You get a sense of her heightened senses, just the things that she could feel and sense even without having sight or sound in her life. Truly amazing stuff. I love in this version of Letters of Note that Aldous Huxley wrote to George Orwell comparing visions of the future. What was going on there?
Sorry. Yeah, this is another incredible letter. So this was 1949. This was shortly after 1984 had been published. George Orwell got a letter from Aldous Huxley, and it's basically a comparison of the two novels, these two dystopian novels, you know, about these quite similar but very different novels. And it's just an incredible, I love these moments where you can see, famous people kind of, not sparring, but kind of meet a meeting of minds, you know, it's a side of this a relationship you wouldn't normally see. I managed to track down the original a copy of the letter as well. You can see that in the book, and I love the fact that you can see all the mistakes that have been crossed.
And in fact, I mean, that is a major aim of yours, to make sure that the letters actually are there, often alongside in picture, if they're a little hard to read with handwriting. That adds a lot, doesn't it?
Indeed. And you know, when I first started this project, I thought, you know, but anthologies of letters have existed for a long time. This isn't a first. but I wanted to try and make it kind of unique. So, yeah, the idea was to make a beautiful big coffee table book that, you know, in which you could see copies of the original letters themselves. So you could see, you know, people's handwriting or the smudges or the, you know, just seeing the paper someone's chosen and their letterhead. It adds another dimension to the whole experience, and it brings you closer to the to that moment. It brings you closer to that person, and it just kind of heightens the whole experience. And it takes a lot of work, but you know, it's so worth the effort, because without that, you know, without that dimension, I'm not sure it would be quite as enjoyable.
There are letters from fictional characters here. Marge Simpson wrote a letter to whom?
she wrote a letter to Barbara Bush. So this was in 1990. So Barbara Bush, the first lady, had it was in an interview with People magazine. She described the Simpsons as being the dumbest thing she'd ever seen. So Matt Groening, in character as Marge Simpson, wrote a letter to Barbara Bush and said, she said she was very hurt to be criticised like that. She said, "Heaven knows we're far from perfect, and if truth be known, maybe just a wee bit short of normal. But as Dr. Seuss says, a person is a person." It's brilliant, and it's on Simpson's letterhead, and it's signed by Marge. It's just such a fantastic thing.
But there's a reply. That's the best part.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Barbara Bush replied, and she says, "Please forgive a loose tongue. Warmly, Barbara Bush. P.S. Homer looks like a handsome fella."
This is great stuff. There's just such great material in it. It truly is a large coffee table book. Letters of Note, Volume 2, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. Sean Usher compiled this, as he's been doing for years. Sean, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.